Blog Talk Radio.
That reminds me. I was coaching in Omaha in 1948, and Eddie Shore sends me this guy that's a terrible masturbator, you know, couldn't control himself. Well, he would get deliberate penalties so he could get into the penalty box all by himself, and damned if he wouldn't.
Oh,
George. What was his name?
Pull my pants down a little bit and show him the Hockey Night logo.
Hey!
Who wants to have some fun?
All right. How everybody? Caffeine rush. How's it going, everybody? It is Chris Block here on the Third Man In Radio here on this Tuesday night, October the 19th, 2010. It is 8:01 here in Chicago. It is the Third Man In, and I am, of course, Chris Block, writer, editor, keeper, creator of thethirdmanin.com, here on Blog Talk Radio tonight. And, of course, Superstar, how you doing?
I'm well. Block, I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
After a night out on the town, have you ever woken up in the back of a landscaping truck?
Nope, not a landscaping truck. A vehicle, yeah, but not a landscaping truck.
Okay, just making sure. I'm busting people off my list.
Do we really need to get into what you and your friends are up to over the weekend?
No, we probably shouldn't. Just enough to say that it was not me, the superstar, who woke up in the back of a landscaping truck at the Foundry at 6 o'clock Sunday morning.
How was the Foundry on Saturday night, by the way?
It was good. It was good. We didn't get there until after the Blackhawk victory, but there was still a good Blackhawk crowd there, and it was my maiden voyage to the Foundry, so I took everything in. It was a very nice, very cool place for those who haven't been there, and I hope to make it back soon.
I wish I would have known that you were going there ahead of time. I would have had you said hi to some of the barmaids there. Nice ladies over there. The Foundry.
Very nice. Very nice ladies. Took very good care of us, and more importantly, the drunken debacle that is my friend that was there with me.
Saturday night, of course, the Buffalo Sabres came to town in the big rematch with the Chicago Blackhawks from this past, or the Monday night previous that we spoke of last week on the show. Nicklas Hjalmarsson making his way back into the lineup after a two-game suspension. Did you see the matchup? I know that you got to the bar late, but did you see any of the matchup? What did you think of that game and Hjalmarsson's two-game suspension and then return?
You know, the game against Buffalo and St. Louis, they're just sloppy right now. I don't think they're playing as a unit. I see a lot of individual play. Obviously, they were fortunate enough to come out with the victory against the backup, Patrick Laine. But they're finding ways to win, and they're not winning pretty, though. Not the way we kind of expected them to win games after coming into this year and after last year. But, you can't say that they're playing too awful, because they're finding ways to win, albeit really ugly.
Yeah, two back-to-back come-from-behind wins at home. Of course, as we spoke of, Saturday night against Buffalo Sabres, Blackhawks down 3-1, 3-2 going into the third period. They come back with two goals. Dave Bolin with his first of the year, finally a Dave Bolin appearance about halfway through the third period. And then, of course, a few minutes later, Patrick Sharp with the power play tally put the Blackhawks over for good. And then last night at the United Center, St. Louis Blues, in a game that the Blues really should have never lost, Blackhawks come from behind with a great third period, and then Patrick Sharp in the overtime with a feed over from Patrick Kane. Let me ask you, what the heck was Barrett Jackman doing on the game winner in overtime last night?
I don't know. I was hoping you had an answer for that, because I have no idea at all. believe it was Nick Boynton who carried the puck behind the net. It was a really great play, and Olczyk pointed
out.
Pointed it out really well that he very easily could have just dumped that thing around to Patrick Kane on the other, you know, the far wall. But instead, he carried it and opened up a ton of space, not only for Kane, but obviously for Sharp as well.
Well, the play essentially is two things. Cullen Ward carrying the puck around the net, holding the puck, and then making that nice little pass over to Kane. But the goal never happens, most likely. The goal never happens unless, well, if Barrett-Jackman just stays on his feet instead of inexplicably dropping to his knees on the goal line. I don't know what he was thinking. I mean, he was trying to prevent Patrick Kane from passing the puck around the net. I don't know what he was doing, but he drops to his knees on the goal line. He puts his stick to defend, like I said, a pass to behind the net, which shouldn't be his concern, but he's Barrett-Jackman. So, I mean, there's really no making any kind of sense out of what he's doing. And, of course, that gives Patrick Kane all kinds of time because now the closest defender is on his knees for Patrick Sharp to wheel back around, get into position, and there's a huge passing lane there now. Instead of two sticks in that lane, there's only one, and you just don't give. I mean, the goal never happens if Jackman doesn't drop to his knees, but that's what great players do. You don't give them that kind of time and space. You know, if that's Jack Skilly, we'll get into Jack Skilly in a bit, but if that's Jack Skilly, maybe that pass doesn't happen because, you know, he's not Patrick Kane. He doesn't have that kind of patience. Maybe he just turns and throws that puck on net or backs off and throws it to the point or something. But because it's Patrick Kane, you don't give a guy like that time and space because he will find Patrick Sharp, one of his favorite targets, in a game ended. But, yeah, that was of course, a great performance by Marian Hossa, who continues to be dominant in this early part of the season. And where would the Blackhawks be without Marian Hossa, superstar? I mean, this is, you know, you got Taves off to his typical slow start. Patrick Kane, who, for the most part, looks disinterested right now. I don't know if he's still sick. I don't know what the deal is with Patrick Kane. But, he's hitting points, but he's not dominating. He doesn't look like the player that he should be at this stage. So you're without those two guys. Sharp has had a good start, but those first two games coming back after the concussion that kept him out of the home opener, he didn't look sharp, so to speak. But he's back on it now. Without those two guys, the Blackhawks would be lucky to have 4 points. I mean, honestly. But
and you know what? And lately, and the three-game winning streak, you could also throw Marty Turco in there.
You should. I mean, you should. After I kind of zinged him in the Committed Indian on Saturday night, he comes up with two great performances against Buffalo. He was very good against Buffalo and again last night against St. Louis. Made a lot of good stops. St. Louis, I like St. Louis this year. I think that the Central Division is going to beat up on each other, and I think that the bottom half of the Western Conference is so mediocre that I think a team like the St. Louis Blues is going to be – they'll be good enough, and they've got a very good goalie that if they give him any kind of help at all, should be able to get them into the postseason. But the thing that separates the rest of the best in the West from a team like the St. Louis Blues is they just don't have anybody that can take, you know, forget about taking over a game, but anybody that can really lead them. Brad Boyes isn't that guy. Patrick Berglund isn't that guy. Backes isn't that guy. I don't know if Oshie's ever going to be that guy. David Perron, you know, two goals last night, he's got that kind of ability. But Perron, you know, those are his first two goals of the season last night. He disappears for stretches. And he's got terrific ability, but sometimes he's kind of like Chris Versteeg. Sometimes he's a little too cute, loses focus, and he's not a guy that you can count on. A great supporting cast player. That's what separates the Blues from the rest. And they've got a defense, Koliakovo, Jackman, Eric Johnson is, you know, I don't know that he's ever going to be dominant, but he's definitely a good kid as far as ability goes, and a good kid off the ice. But I don't know exactly what you're going to get there. Petriangelo is going to be a good player, but overall that defense really is mediocre at best. We saw it again last night. The Blues Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
The Blues played almost perfect hockey for 50 minutes, and they still couldn't come away with a victory against the Blackhawks. They get the 1 point, which is good for them on the road, but that's a game that they should have won. And, you know, I think, let's go over the four games since we last spoke. Of course, last night, the Blackhawks overtime 3-2, come from behind win against the Blues, down 2-0, and three unanswered, two by Marian Hossa, and then Patrick Sharp in overtime. Saturday night, like we said, 4-3 over Buffalo, Patrick Laine in net for Buffalo instead of Ryan Miller. A lot of sub stories in that one. We'll go into that one. The 4-3 Blackhawks win that one. Friday night in Columbus, dominating a bad Columbus team. 5-2 victory in Columbus. Again, Marty Turco in net for that one. Not challenged so much in that game and managed to give up a bad goal in the second, very beginning of the second period. Kicked the puck into his own net when he was facing a play. He managed to be facing a player that was standing behind the net when he was supposed to be defending his goal. Marty Turco lets up the first goal in Columbus that way by kicking the puck into his own net. Not intentionally, but he did. I think of the three games this week, the game that I was most impressed with the Blackhawks was the one that they actually lost. It was the best team that they played, the Nashville Predators, playing a style that, you know, it was a game at home where Nashville came in and dictated the kind of game that they wanted to play. And the Blackhawks weren't at their best, but they didn't get frustrated. They stuck in that game, and they, you know, until the that was the game to me that I looked at the Blackhawks and I said, you know what, this is the way this entire season is going to go, just because they don't have that kind of depth. And until some of these guys like Kane, Taves, get on hot streaks, until they get something from their supporting cast, the Phillies, the Pisanis, Victor Stahlberg scoring his first goal last Friday night in Columbus. Big deal. He was a scratch last night. Until they get some kind of effort or performance and production from their supporting cast, Dave Bolin included, this is the way this is going to be. It's going to be tough games against teams like the Blues and the Sabres and the Nashville Predators. And you'll have to rack up points against Columbus, Edmonton, teams like that. A true test will be coming in tomorrow night, Vancouver Canucks. Next Wednesday night, L.A. Kings come to town. These are these are huge matchups for the Blackhawks. And if Hossa is not playing at the level that he's at now, they don't even stand a chance in these games, because they're still waiting for Kane and Taves to get it going. But I was really impressed with the Blackhawks. They lost, a late third period goal. A bad penalty at the very end with Nick Boynton shooting the puck over the glass. The puck just sort of rides up on a stick. He's trying to clear it around the boards. It hops up into the crowd. Bad break for Nick Boynton, but Joel Ward scores the game winner on the power play. They lose that game 3-2. But I still think of the four games this week, that was the game that I thought the Blackhawks proved to me that, you know, they can play these games and they'll play a team's whatever style the other team wants to play, they can play it still and manage to be in the hockey game and be in a position to win it by the game's end.
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought they played well against Nashville, and I think that showed maybe even a little bit of effect of the AKA short summer that they had. The question I had going back to the St. Louis game and watching the Blues is, in my opinion, and tell me if I'm right on this, it almost seems like the Blues are, as far as developing a team, taking the next steps, maybe 1 to 1.5 years behind the Nashville Predators, which doesn't start with good things, because the Hawks always seem to have, I don't want to say trouble, but those games are always very highly contested. When you think of a Blackhawks team that you know, is far more talented than both of those teams, should be able to come in and I don't want to say push them around, but kind of rely on their talent to win those games. To me, it seemed like watching the St. Louis game that the Blues aren't that far off from being the Nashville Predators.
Yeah, and I'll say that I'll play contrarian here. They're not, but they've got a lot of their future is riding on where TJ Oshie is a year and two from now, where Patrick Berglund is a year and two from now, I mean, what becomes of Eric Johnson? I mean, those three players specifically, throw in Perron. Because guys like David Backes, Alexander Steen, Brad Boyes, those are, I mean, they're tremendous support players. But like I said before, St. Louis is lacking true frontline talent. They don't have anybody that you know, man-on-man that can compete. They don't have anybody that can compete with the Blackhawks at a high level. And as much as we should admire, and we had Buddy Oaks from PredsOnTheGlass.com last week and Preds on the Glass Radio here on Blog Talk Radio, and as much as we should admire the Nashville Predators, the fact is the Nashville Predators are a team that's at a certain level, and that level doesn't resemble success. Yeah, you get into the playoffs and you lose in the first round, but where does that get you? That gets you to a position where, you know, Shea Weber's contract's coming due this year, and if he signs a one-year extension, then he's a UFA after next year. They're in a position where if things don't start looking up for that franchise, maybe Shea Weber starts looking for a new address. So there's got to be something more there. You know, in Nashville, I don't know where that is. You know, I mean, they have age. Some of their best players are aging, and you know, Steve Sullivan, J.P. Dumont, Martin Erat. These aren't necessarily, you know, household names that, you know, that resonate winning, you know. And in St. Louis, it's a lot of the same. You got Andy McDonald. You know, Steen's still a young guy, but Brad Boy, I mean, Brad Boyes is kind of what he is. He's, you know, they have two more years with him at $4 million a year. Alexander Steen, they've got, one more year, excuse me. Alexander Steen is locked up through 2013-14 at about like $3.3 million. It's a good number for him, but he's a supporting cast guy. David Backes is a supporting cast guy. They need guys to step up and you know, be something more if they're going to take that next step. If you want to be the Nashville Predators, that's great, but where's that going to get you? I mean, the goal is to be great. And I don't see. I like the Blues this year. I like them to get into the playoffs. They can upset a team in the first round, but I just don't see it. They don't have enough scoring talent to. And their defense is there's something lacking on that back line too, and it's inconsistency more than anything. But your point's valid. I mean, it's a good comparison. I just think that, you know, if that's what you aspire to be, I think you need to get out of the business.
Point taken.
You know, the game in, against Buffalo, and we're going to talk. We got a lot of stuff to talk about tonight on the show. First of all, I do have the Bob Probert book, "Tough Guy: My Life on the Edge." Bob Probert with Kirstie McClellan Day. And special forward by Danny Probert. It's not and Steve Yzerman as well. Steve Yzerman's about a two-page forward. Danny Probert's not much of a forward. It's about a paragraph and two sentences. But yeah, got that in. It's an interesting book, Superstar.
I can imagine.
It's really interesting. In a lot of the same ways that Theo Fleury's book was interesting. At this time last year, and even to this day, remains interesting, the more and more we learn about Theo Fleury. But, yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on, but we got a lot of Hawks stuff to do and some Ice Hawks notes as well. Buffalo Saturday night. First of all, the results of our poll from last week on the website, what discipline should Nicholas Jalmerson have received for his hit on Jason Pominville, our readers and listeners, 54.3% said 1 to 2 games, and it ended up being 2 games. And some of these votes came in after the verdict, so, you know, but about 20% said 3 or more. Game misconduct and the major was enough, again, about 20%. 4.3 said it should be as many games as Pominville was going to miss, and 2.2% said Nicholas Jalmerson did nothing wrong. He shouldn't have been penalized to begin with.
Moron.
Did you see the Sporting News naming Chicago the best top sports city?
Yeah, I did. I did. I don't know if
did
I
you,
agree
Did you
with
see
it.
The issue?
You know what? I just saw a clipping. I want to say it was you know, kind of a reprint on one of the local websites. So I did not see the whole issue, no.
Okay. Well, I have it in front of me. The interesting thing about this, now, I have a lot of problems with this. It's like, you know, God bless the sporting news for being relevant a couple of times a year. But, you know, they do this list in which they, you know, 402 cities, right? 402 markets, essentially. Because some of these, like, they, you know, they link the quad cities together. You know, the tri-cities in Washington. But how do you differentiate between Macomb, Illinois, and DeKalb, Illinois, or Carbondale, Illinois? Like, what makes, well, let's just take a look at it. What makes DeKalb number 124 best sports market in the country, as opposed to Carbondale, which comes in at 161, as opposed to Macomb, that comes in at 238?
I don't know. The amount of beer that's sold prior and after games, I don't have an answer for you there.
And what about, like, isn't, you know, I don't know. The city that comes in last, 402, is Yakima, Washington. But Hilton Head, South Carolina, which isn't that like a golf, you know, capital of the Southeast, comes in at
313. Yeah, it is a golf mecca, that's for sure.
All right, well, that comes in at 313. I mean, I don't know. Troy Brower is, they do this thing where they ask these players, Troy Brower, these are Troy Brower's answers to the following question. One word that describes Chicago fans, he says enthusiastic. Current star Troy Brower would start a team with Jonathan Toews. Coolest things about the city, he says the waterfront. My team's biggest rival, Troy Brower's answer to that question, the Vancouver Canucks. I'm sure some people would take issue with that. Even though people, you know, a lot of people don't like the Vancouver Canucks, but Chicago. This is what his what he thinks the Chicago sports motto should be: we only tolerate winners. And that's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, obviously he's not a Cubs fan.
Well, the next question that they ask him: best uniform other than your own? He says the Cubs.
Maybe he's a dumb Cubs fan.
Oh, Matt Forte, he would start a sports franchise with Derrick Rose. But anyway,
kind of he didn't really step out on any limbs with those answers, did he? The only shocking thing is when he the best thing about the city, if it wasn't, you know, downtown, waterfront, blah blah blah, most of the other answers you're going to get on that one is the food.
Well, so that would be
we do. Yeah, I mean, we do have great food in the city. But, you know, when you hear and read those kind of questions answered by athletes about Chicago, that's an answer you get pretty frequently is the food.
All right, superstar. Jack Skilly, a healthy scratch on Saturday against the Buffalo Sabres. Victor Stahlberg, healthy scratch last night against the St. Louis Blues. Why? Because Joe Quenneville decided that he needed John Scott, all 6'8" of him, on the right wing to play 3 or 4 minutes in the course of an entire hockey game. Your thoughts?
Oh, I think I just threw up in my mouth. I don't know why. I mean, let me ask you this. Has either one of those guys, Skilly, and I know you're not a fan of Stahlberg, done anything that you would say, these guys are going to cut it? We, you know, they're in the doghouse. Why? I thought they have looked great all year for what they are. Let's put it that way. And I don't understand this move because John Scott is god-awful. I would rather dress you than John Scott if I was running a professional franchise.
Well, not with my blown out knee, but maybe
five months ago.
It's a toss up between me and Brian Noonan.
Yeah, he's completely fucking useless. I don't understand it. He brings nothing to the table for me.
All right. Well, of course, the backstory on this is that the Buffalo Sabres angry that Nicholas Jalmerson hits Jason Pominville from behind, and Pominville, you know, bounces his head off the glass, ends up with a concussion, is missing time. Patrick Kaleta, a member of the Buffalo Sabres, vows revenge. And with Kaleta and primarily Cody McCormick in the lineup, you know, I mean, there's an element there that you have to be concerned that maybe certain guys would try to start the rough stuff against the Blackhawks on Saturday night. But, you know, so Joe Quenneville decides that he needs John Scott in the lineup. Okay. Last night, he does the same thing. He's got John Scott in the lineup to play right wing. Of course, John Scott is a defenseman. He has John Scott in the lineup to play right wing, the fourth line with, you know, predominantly Jake Dahl, Fernando Pisani. You know, I don't have a problem. I don't have much, you know. Let me address your first point. Okay, you say those guys are playing great. Skilly and Stahlberg are playing great for what they are. That's a good point, because for what they are, they're third and fourth line energy guys. Okay, I know that, and I'll mention them because, you know, I know that he's got a thick skin and he doesn't mind being mentioned. But, you know, Sam Fells, editor of the Committed Indian, very upset about Skilly and Stahlberg being left out of the lineup, and I know that Sam thinks that you know, he's on a Skilly kick right now, and, you know. But Skilly and Stahlberg are playing against the other team. One of the things about Joe Quenneville is he's high on matchups. You know, you don't see a Joe Quenneville coach team very often, you know, that has the fourth line sent out intentionally against someone else's second or third. It just doesn't happen very much. Occasionally it'll happen when he's mad at, you know, he's mad or he's looking for a change of pace or something like that. But in the course of a game, an evenly played game, you just don't see it. Joe Quenneville doesn't allow it. So most of their success, and it's not even success, they're not between the two of them up to this point of the season, they have a goal and an assist.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, they produce a lot more than on the score sheet.
Okay, but they're quick. They can forecheck, and occasionally they can create scoring chances against that the comparable level of competition. What does that make them? That makes them supporting cast role players. Okay, until they prove that they could put the puck in the net against the competition that's at their level, I mean, why are we pining for these guys? You know, unless it's like, you know, I always get accused of this, complaining about something just to complain about something. You know, it's just having a gripe to have a gripe. It's like the Blackhawks aren't blowing teams out of the arena, so everybody's looking for the problem. Well, the problem is the Blackhawks don't have the team they had last year. This is going to be more difficult. Okay, you can't flick a switch and Jack Skilly turns into Chris Versteeg, and Victor Stahlberg becomes whatever, you know, he's going to become. It just doesn't happen that way. They are what they are, and Joe Quenneville knows that. You can't trust either one of them completely in a defensive role against the other team's best lines. You just can't do it. You know. So, and the one thing that Pisani does bring, and I don't think very highly of Pisani. I don't think he can do anything for you offensively, but he knows where to be on the ice. In the offensive zone, he may not get there, but he knows his role. His role is to be a defensive guy, to be in the right position all the time and be, you know, support in, you know, in the neutral zone and defensively. He knows those roles. He doesn't get ahead of himself. I've made the prediction that I don't think he'll be on the team come December. But for now, until Skilly and Stallbird, you know, their games become more all-encompassing, then, you know, you're kind of stuck with what you have. And I don't find it any grave injustice that Jack Skilly had to sit a game. I mean, what, you know, Jack Skilly, part, you could say, and I'm hard on Dave Bolin, and I think it's more Dave Bolin's fault than, you know, he's got to take accountability. He's the veteran. He's the center of that third line. He's got to be the guy that makes it go. But part of the reason why Dave Bolin isn't going is because he has nobody with, you know, who's he playing with? You know, I mean, he doesn't have Martin Havlat. He doesn't have Chris Versteeg, Andrew Ladd, or Dustin Byfuglien anymore, or Troy, you know, Troy Brouwer. He doesn't have those guys. You know, he's stuck with Fasani, Bickle, Stallberg, and Skilly. There's going to be an adjustment period. So I don't think, as far as, you know, against Buffalo, you know, I didn't understand why, you know, again, it's just Cody McCormick. And Patrick Collette is really not going to fight anybody. He's like Burrish. He's just out there to stir up crap, and that's all he does. Okay? So you have Nick Boynton in the lineup. You have Brian Bickle. Those guys can handle that kind of stuff, and if Buffalo wants to get out of their game and start running around and taking penalties, then I'll let them. Go on the power play. The Blackhawks need plenty of work on the power play, so just let them put you on the power play. Say thank you and score goals.
I'm liking the over on that power play.
Maybe we should talk about the power play later, because that second power play unit is brutal.
Yeah,
the only reason why it even belongs on the ice is because Marian Hossa's on it. It's Marian Hossa and four bums is what it is. Because Brent Seabrook's a bum right now. Dave Bolin can't, you know, again, Dave Bolin on the point on the power play, it hasn't worked in how long, and we're still going with it. It's like that second power play unit is so bad. Why not put Dave Bolin on the half wall? We're down in the corner. You got Hossa on the other side, and you send Brouwer or Bickle or whoever you want to the net, and put real defensemen on the point. You know,
it makes sense to me.
If you're gonna pay Halmerson $3.5 million a year, they didn't want to, but if you're going to, why can't this guy play on the second power play unit? You know, if you're that high on him, you think that much of him, he should be able to. If you want to front load your first power play unit, and there's a theory of thought that says that you should. So you've got Toews and Kane and Sharp and Kopechki in the Thomas Holmstrom role in front of the net, and your best defenseman Duncan Keith back on the point in the first power play, fine. But put a real centerman in there to, you know, Dave Bolin's very good at going down low, typically in the playoffs. He's very good at going down low, getting pucks, and cycling out of there. He's good at that. So put him in that role, because he doesn't belong on the point on the power play.
Obviously you're missing Brian Campbell, who's going to quarterback, you know, the power play. And I think the problems on that second power play line speak to what you and I have been talking about since coming into the year, and that is the lack of depth on this team that we had last year. It's just not there, and they got to go with what they have, which, you know, when it comes to power play time is, for lack of a better word, icky.
You know, and Scott, playing last night against the Blues, and again, take a little look at the score sheet. Scott played 2 minutes and 29 seconds last night.
See, I think you were being a little contradictory, because while you don't have an issue with Jack Skilly sitting out a game, I mean, who that's on the roster right now would you rather have moved up there? I mean, it's why have those guys sit and bring up a defenseman to play 2 minutes of a game? See, that's the thing that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you could say that, but clearly Jack Skilly is not doing something that is being asked of him, because even though John Scott only plays 2.5 minutes last night, how much time did Jack Skilly see? He played under 7 minutes. You know, so clearly, you know, you can't just say, oh, I like Jack Skilly because he's fast and occasionally he breaks free up the wing and he takes a shot and that stands out to you and that's exciting to you. Okay, that's fine. But there are reasons why these guys don't play. We may not know them, but Joe Quenneville didn't become an idiot overnight. You know, and that's why I wrote in the Community Indian Center tonight, I'm not ready to go, you know, and play the contrarian with Joe Quenneville. I'm not ready to do that yet. There are little things that stand out to me that I say, why did he do that? Like in the game against Nashville last Wednesday night, Jake Dowell had lost. Going into that face-off that was right before the Boynton shooting the puck over the glass, you know, with 2.5 minutes left in that game, or 3 minutes left in that game, that led to the Joel Ward power play goal, you know, that won the game for Nashville. Jake Dowell had won only one of his last 15 faceoffs taken. And there he is with under 3 minutes left in a game taking an important faceoff. It was in the neutral zone, albeit. But what is Jake Dowell doing on the ice in a tie game with under 3 minutes left in a game to begin with? And secondly, why is he taking a faceoff?
I would
like to ask Joe Quenneville that question. I would ask Joe Quenneville that question. You know, but that's something I can criticize. You know, he must have his reasons for not playing Jack Skilly. You know, I watched Jack Skilly last night. Jack Skilly infuriated me last night in the second period. I think it was about 7 minutes in. I don't have my notes in front of me. About 7 minutes in, St. Louis turns the puck over in the neutral zone. Fernando Pisani gets the puck, and he throws I saw the play, you know, from your television perspective, he throws the puck down to the wall where Jack Skilly has. Not along the wall, but, you know, that half of the ice. The Blues, for some reason, continue to take, you know, go off on their change. Their defensemen are changing. Roman Polak jumps off the bench. Now, Jack Skilly gets the puck. Roman Polak is just off the bench. What does Jack Skilly do? Instead of getting the puck and skating as hard as he can, because he is clear and unabated towards Yaroslav Halak. No, Jack Skilly slows up, hesitates in the neutral zone, and allows Roman Polak to get back into his defensive position to defend the 2-on-1, Pisani and Skilly, which is, you know, kind of a joke as it is. But still, it was a 2-on-1, or at least a clear opportunity for Jack Skilly to charge the net, and at the very least, get Roman Polak to make, you know, an irrational, quick decision that may have led to a better chance. As it was, Jack Skilly hesitates. He slowly skates through the neutral zone, and then he winds up, you know, in one of those James Wisniewski windups that, two or three seconds go by between the moment that you realize that he's going to take that big slap shot until he actually releases it. And I don't know why Halak, you know, even gave a rebound. I think he was being cocky. But it was just infuriating. And I'd have to go back and look to see how many shifts Skilly had after that, because I don't think it was many. I mean, it was so aggravating.
Well, you brought something else up that kind of concerned me, and that was, I don't know if you have the score sheet from last night so handy, and I don't know if Anya has where the faceoffs are taken, but they look god-awful taking faceoffs, especially in the defensive zone. It seemed like every time there was a defensive zone faceoff, especially as the game went on and got later, they were getting beat worse and worse on those draws. And when you're in a tight game, whether you're down 2-1 or even 2-0, you can't be losing that many draws in your own end.
Yeah, you're right. Jonathan Toews last night in the defensive zone, 1-for-6. Jake Dowell only took 5 faceoffs last night. He won 3 of them. They were all in the offensive zone. Dave Bolin, 2-for-9 in the defensive zone. Sharp was 1-for-1 in the defensive zone. 60% overall for Sharp, 57% overall for Toews. But you're right, they're not winning them in their own zone, which is it's a big problem.
It just sets up trouble. And, once again, you'd have to pay attention more than I did. But how many of those were after an icing call? Maybe the guys were gassed. But, yeah, you're not going to succeed very much losing that many draws. And from what I saw, a lot of them weren't 50-50 and, the Blues did their first. They were clean wins right back to the Blues point, man. That's troublesome.
Also last night, after a couple of games of a break for Duncan Keith. Duncan Keith, of course, the first 4 games of the season, he's playing over half of the game in each of those first 4 contests. Got a break, of course, with the blowout in Columbus on Friday night. Saturday, he's back up to 28.5 minutes against the Sabres. And then again last night against the Blues, Duncan Keith with a little over 31 minutes.
Oh.
Bring this up. Go ahead.
I was just saying that's a lot of hockey. That's something that you can make note of now, but you better be paying attention to that come playoff time.
Well, I don't think you have to wait till playoff time. I think you should be paying attention to it right now. I mean, the Blackhawks are in the midst of a crazy month. I mean, we talked about it last week. 7 games in 11 days. This is a lot of hockey. At the beginning of a season, especially now, you talk about the Blackhawks look out of sync. I mean, they're struggling to stay into these games. Duncan Keith is exerting himself. He's not playing well. He's probably pressing. He's definitely pressing. It looks like he's pressing. He's turning the puck over way more than a Norris Trophy defenseman should. A lot of that is still I mean, Duncan Keith, there's sort of a misnomer that Duncan Keith played perfect hockey last year. He did not. Far from it. He won defensively. When you look at Duncan Keith's defensive game last year, he won the Norris Trophy based on what he did the prior year. And a lot of these trophies, that's what happened. Jonathan Toews may win the Norris Trophy this year. The Selke Trophy this year, but it will be based off a reputation that he built in the playoffs and this past the season just before the Cup Championship season. If he can sustain it, a lot of these things it takes a year for him to take effect. Duncan Keith actually took a step down defensively, but because he went up offensively, he was a shoe-in in most people's minds for the Norris. But Duncan Keith does make a lot of mistakes out there, and he's making a lot of them right now. But yes, he's playing way too much hockey, and that's not Joe Quenneville's fault. That's Dan Bowman. We talked about it. It's unfortunate Brian Campbell went down, but last year, the season before, the Blackhawks were remarkably healthy. As a GM, you have to know that eventually that luck is going to turn around on you. And defensively, when the Blackhawks – see, Stan Bowman, I like Stan Bowman, and I think that he's done a lot of good, and he's probably deserves, a degree of credit to some of the moves that Dale Talon gets a lot of credit for, being assistant GM and being involved in a lot of that scouting and evaluating and that decision process, just like Rick Dudley. I give Rick Dudley a lot of credit for the Talon regime. We should give Stan Bowman as well. But Stan Bowman, not understanding, it's like first and foremost, and we'll just say primarily with John Scott, not understanding or at least ignoring why this team is so good and where that offense is generated from and the game that the Blackhawks play. It all starts with the blue line. And to have guys that you don't trust and that are immobile and, you know, your coach doesn't want to play in the 5 and the 6 spot and then, you know, in the emergency 7 and 8, you know, it's when you have an injury, it's going to create this issue where Duncan Keith's got to play in an enormous amount of minutes, and eventually it will wear him down to where he'll be playing. It'll have one of two effects. Either he'll be playing even worse hockey than he is now, or he's going to get injured. There's only two options there. If he keeps playing half the game, you know, if the Blackhawks, let's just say the Blackhawks play 4 games a week and 2 of those games, or 3 games a week and 2 of those games that Duncan Keith plays near or over 30 minutes, the cumulative effect over time, whether it hits in November on the road trip, whether it hits in December, or whether it hits in January or, you know, February road trip, the cumulative effect will, Duncan Keith will either wear out to the point his game is going to suffer even more than it is now, or he's going to get hurt. And that falls on Stan Bowman. Because Joel Quenneville's job is to win hockey games. And if he's not putting his best players out there in order to win hockey games, then he's not doing his job as a head coach. So that's how you have Duncan Keith out there for way more minutes than, you know, realistically, you don't want Duncan Keith playing over 27 minutes a night. So maybe 4 shifts, 5 shifts doesn't sound like a lot, but when, you know, the other part of this equation is that Keith and Seabrook are out there 10 seconds too long on all of these shifts, which makes the problem even worse. Their shifts are 10 seconds longer than Joe Quenneville would want them to be. Because he doesn't, you know, he wants them out there more, and they're afraid to take changes sometimes because of the matchup issue with putting Cullimore and Nick Boynton out there, putting a Nicholas Jalmerson, who's having a bad start to the season. You know, those two guys, Keith and Seabrook, are staying out there 10, 15 seconds too long. And again, you got tired defensemen out there at the end of shifts that get caught. Eventually, one of them is going to get hurt. And you would hope that, you know, Stan Bowman could do something to correct that issue. Now, it sounds as though that Brian Campbell's a tad bit ahead of schedule and is about 2 weeks away from returning. That would be great news. It would be about a week before they originally thought he would return. So that would be great. Because that'll take those 3-4 extra shifts a game off of Campbell. Maybe that, you know, that gets those guys back to 45, 50-second shifts on the defense, and everything sort of balances and falls back into place. You know, you've got your third defensive pairing playing 10, 11, 12, 13 minutes a night, and you've got your specialties again. You've got Duncan Keith on one power play unit. You've got Campbell and Seabrook on the second, and Jalmerson is, you know, in there with Keith and Seabrook killing penalties with, you know, whoever the other guy is, whether it's Boynton, whether it ends up being Cullimore, whatever. You know, but everything starts to fall in place. Campbell being out of this equation is killing them right now. But still, you know, not having someone who could step up and fill that role, you know, I always brought up the name Randy Jones, and Randy Jones isn't the great, you know, he isn't a great defenseman, but he's a guy that's played a lot of minutes at this level and can move and contribute a little bit offensively, and he's not the worst defensive player around. You know, you'd certainly prefer to have Randy Jones playing where Nick Boynton is right now, next to Jalmerson. And when Campbell gets healthy, your third unit's even better. So, but that's a tired argument. Nick Leddy gets sent down. What do you think?
Well, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I started thinking, like, you having him up here is doing nothing but hurting his development. But I don't think he did anything wrong. I think the mistakes he made were honest mistake that you would think a 19-year-old kid would make. And you know, I don't think he cost them or did anything glaring where you were going to say this kid doesn't have a future. You know, we've seen what he's got. And, you know, I don't know. I like the idea of him going down to Rockford, getting more ice time, developing his skills. So that way when we do bring him back, you know, we get more of a complete player, regardless of when that's going to be down the line.
Yeah, you know, I think that before the season, I think pretty much everybody was on the same page, aside from the fans that, you know, they get excited and they root for a 19-year-old kid because it's a great story. I think everybody else was kind of on the same page. What is this kid, you know, doing up here? They're rushing him. You know, they could hurt him. You know, or, his long-term projections as a player by rushing him. I think everybody was sort of on the same page. Then fast forward, Nick Leddy's in the lineup. He doesn't look so bad. But again, Joe Quenneville is managing his shifts. He's not out there against the best players all the time. And, yeah, he looks serviceable. One thing that didn't happen, well, that I thought would happen, it would make sense, the other teams didn't really attack him much. I thought that we'd see more of that. I thought that we'd see a team like Colorado, Nashville, dump the puck in on Letty's side and go down there and ram him as much as possible. That didn't really happen. So Blackhawks kind of got lucky there. But, you know, it's, you know, people see Nick Leddy and he sort of, it's like, well, he kind of fits in and he, you know, he's fast and the Blackhawks are missing Brian Campbell. So he adds a little bit of that speed and he doesn't look out of place. And every once in a, you know, once a game he makes a play and Eddie Olczyk and Pat Foley make sure to be demonstrative and point it out and say, God, this guy's, you know, he's 19 and look at this kid play. So you sort of, your opinion sort of gets distorted in that, you know, you think, well, wait a minute, he's kind of fitting in, forgetting that it's like, no, you know, your original stance, which was the correct one, is that, no, the kid needs to go and play somewhere where he can play in all different situations. He can play 20, 22, 24 minutes a night in Rockford, if that's where they, you know, he must go in Stan Bowman's eyes. Then go to Rockford, play 20 minutes a night, play on the power play, play on the PK, and become the best player you can possibly be, because that's what benefits the organization the most. Not filling the Jordan Hendry role here. Blackhawks don't need another Jordan Hendry. They need the next Duncan Keith. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for the next Nick Jalmerson, because Nick Jalmerson isn't long for this organization. You know, they're looking for the guy that, if it comes down to in 2 years, a decision between, or even before, you know, this year, if it comes down to the Blackhawks, if Patrick Sharp is going to continue to play out of his mind, when he has his mind, you know, when he has all his wits about him, and he's not concussed, you know, there's a serious question that comes into play: is how much is Patrick Sharp worth, and can the Blackhawks afford, depending on what their plan is in net, can the Blackhawks afford both Patrick Sharp and Brent Seabrook? So you're looking for, whether it's Dylan Olsen, whether it's Nick Leddy, whether it's Sean Lalonde, you know, you're looking for the next. So it doesn't do Nick Leddy any good to play 9, 10, 11 minutes a night here, because that's not what he projects to be. The thing about Duncan Keith was that it didn't matter that he got minutes against the other team's best players, because that was his learning experience. The team could afford it. The Blackhawks can't afford to put Nick Leddy up against the Datsyuk line, like, ever. So, you know, you want to bring Nick Leddy up when you know that you can throw him out in a lot of different situations, and, yeah, you'll gradually put him into those situations, but you have confidence that he can succeed there. Whereas now, you don't have that. And plus, you're not even taking into account that this kid professionally, or not even professionally, in major hockey, has never played more than 50 games with a team. So at some point, the kid's going to hit a wall. And, you know, then it comes into play, is he going to cost you hockey? So they're doing the right thing, you know. But I just found it humorous. It's like, okay, people say, like, okay, well, what's this kid doing here? And he needs to go play games, and then they see him. And it's like, well, he doesn't look so bad. And then they're like, well, why? I don't understand. Why are they sending Nick Leddy down? And then Joe Quenneville explains to you why they're sending him down. And the reasons are the same reasons that you had for him not playing here to begin with, but you're still upset about it. No. You know, pick a side. Yeah. Pick a side, take a stance, and stick to it. You know, you were right the first time. Whether the Blackhawks repeat or not, it's not going to have any. Nick Leddy's not going to have anything to do with it one way or another. But whether the Blackhawks win a Stanley Cup 3, 4, 5 seasons from now, Nick Leddy could very well be a major part of it. So that's what you want Nick Leddy to build toward. So they made the right decision. I mean, he shouldn't have been here to begin with. But you know, again, if there's true competition in camp and Nick Leddy won that competition, I think for the sake of team morale and camaraderie and just the team being able to believe that the coaches and the general manager management are making decisions based on what's happening on the ice, which is important in that room, then okay, he made the team in part because of the Campbell injury, but he made the team, he got a try, you know, up here, he played some games, but now they're doing the best thing for his career. And I applaud them for it.
Right, and you know the one argument that talking to people that about the situation that I heard, and I hate this. I hate it when people use this. I think it's such bullshit that bringing him up gave him a taste and is going to make him work harder to get back to this level. If you're projecting him to one day, and we heard all about it all summer, this kid is the next Duncan Keith. He's going to be up here. He's going to, you know, if his development continues, he's going to be an NHL defenseman. The argument of, oh, bringing him up gave him a taste of what's to come is going to make him work harder. I think it's complete bullshit because I think he knew what was up here. And I don't like that argument. You know, make him work harder to get back. You know. For him to say that he's going to work harder because he's been up here, more so than if he was never up here, is complete crap.
Are you there?
Oh, sorry. I didn't undo my mute button. What was I saying? All right.
I don't know what you were saying. I made my point.
Can you hear me now? Can you
hear me? Yeah, dead in a moment.
Nick Leddy making his debut on Friday night in Rockford at the Metro Center, most likely, against the Abbotsford Heat. Brent Seabrook's little brother Keith in town. Abbotsford, the Rockford was out there in British Columbia this past weekend. Won both of those games, Saturday night in a shootout, 4-3, and then Friday night, Alec Richard blanked the Abbotsford Heat 5-0. Want to make some points on the Rockford IceHogs, first and foremost. Alec Richards is definitely, it appears as though, I mean, he's definitely playing better than Hannu Toivonen at this point. I don't think that head coach Bill Peters is going to play one tremendously more than the other unless Toivonen completely goes in the tank. But at this point, Alec Richards is definitely, if there is a competition there for the number one spot, he's definitely got it right now. Want to make a couple points, talking with a few people, Rockford and then also some other people this past week. I think there should be a lot of concern about the Blackhawks goaltending below Corey Crawford at this point. Alec Richards, while he had a nice weekend last weekend, picked up a couple of wins, I mean, just go back to him in training camp, what we saw of him in exhibition and also the prospect tournament. He's not very polished. There's a lot of holes in his game there. And, you know, I think I don't know how much better he is than he was last year. And last year he was an ECHL goalie. So, you know, I think the biggest weakness on Rockford right now is their goaltending. You know, their defense seems to be now with the addition of Garnet Exelby. When Cullimore's down there, that defense is actually pretty reasonable. But they're a very young team. You know, Jeremy Morin is the youngest player in the entire AHL. Brandon Peary is just 6 days behind him. You know, overall, Rockford, you know, they're about middle of the pack as far as age is in the AHL. Average age is 24.5. It's a little bit lower now that, with Letty there, but Kyle Beach. You know, Kyle Beach didn't make this team because he was sent down primarily because, you know, to round out his game. You know, he doesn't really have a clue defensively. And there's consistency issues with his game. And there's also, I think he has an identity issue. And that, you know, here's a kid with a terrific shot, great release, good instincts in the offensive zone as far as going to spots and when he plays with good players, knowing where he should be to be in position to get pucks for good scoring opportunities. He has that. But is... ability to stay concentrate on that on the ice is somewhat lacking. And, you know, Kyle Beach is not the biggest guy. You know, I heard some people suggest last week leading into the Buffalo game on Saturday night saying, oh, we should call up Jack Skilly, if the game gets rough, or excuse me, Jack, we should call up Kyle Beach because if the game gets rough, you know, we'll need our tough guys in there. Kyle Beach should never be confused for a tough guy. He's not that big. He's tall, but he's not built. And I think one of the things the Blackhawks are going to be looking for from Kyle Beach is to fill out. Because if he's insistent on playing a rough style, or as he's doing in Rockford right now, he's running around and kind of like a crazy person, you know, trying to start stuff, and get under opponent's skin. It's like, I think Kyle Beach should understand, take a step back and understand that, you know what, I've got a lot of skill, and I shouldn't be concerned with that. Let somebody else on the team run around and be an idiot. Let somebody else do the Adam Burris thing. I can score goals, and that's how I'm going to help an NHL hockey team. And learn the defensive aspect. Do what's being asked of them. You know, I mean, there is a consensus in Rockford that Kyle Beach is going to be there for 2 years. Kyle Beach is not, you know, he could get called up, he could get hot, and he could called up. Things can always change, but there is a consensus, there is a thought in Rockford that he's going to be there this year and next, that he's not headed here anytime soon for a long stay. So I think get that thought out of your minds. Unless something drastic happens here, you know, where, you know, you get a ton of injuries and a spot opens up and he's the option, you know, the most realistic option, then, I mean, I don't think you're going to see Kyle Beach anytime soon. Couple other players. I think what should be, I don't think we should be surprised about this, but the guy that people are pretty high on in Rockford, we shouldn't be surprised because he stuck a lot longer in Blackhawks camp than we thought he would, is Ben Smith. You know, and again, I don't know how much stock I take in that, but Ben Smith is a guy that they're apparently pretty high on in Rockford. Igor Makarov, interestingly enough, I don't know how much stock you should put into it because Rockford's penalty kill has been pretty atrocious early on, but Igor Makarov is on the penalty kill out there. And So I think that's, I mean, that's a good sign if Makarov is gonna come to the NHL. Again, you want guys like Makarov who has skill. You want him playing in a lot of different situations down there. Even if he's not going to come up here and be on the PK, it's good that he's down there and he has that experience of playing in those positions, because some of those, you know, when you get pinned in your zone, let's just say, you know, it happens a lot. It happens once a game. You know, a shift happens where you just can't get the puck out of your zone, and you've got a forward line that's pinned in their zone for a minute and are dog tired. Well, it becomes like a shorthanded situation. So if Igor Makarov's in Rockford playing on the PK, even if he's not going to boot Patrick Sharp or Taves and Hossa out of the PK up here, at least he has that experience. So he can use some of those, maybe, you know, build those situations and bring them forward here. You know, again, I don't know how far Igor Makarov is away from, you know, potentially being a Blackhawk. I think a lot of that depends on what happens with Victor Stahlberg. Again, Victor Stahlberg, he's got 19 games here to really show something. Because once he hits game number 20 this season, he becomes waiver eligible. And I think that, you know, there's enough there from Victor Stahlberg with speed and the size, and there's enough promise there that the Blackhawks could lose him. I mean, he doesn't make a lot of money. It's a one-year deal. The Blackhawks could very well lose him had they had to, you know, pass him through waiver. So Victor Stahlberg's got to get himself in here. And again, you know, I know people are rooting for him. It's a big part of whether or not the Blackhawks are going to be good this year is how well Victor Stahlberg does. I mean, him really contributing offensively is huge. So people are kind of rooting for him, and it was a nice goal against Columbus on Friday night. But, you know, this guy lost the competition in training camp to Jeremy Morin, and, you know, I mean, unfortunately, Morin got sent down. Unfortunately, for competition's sake. It was, for Morin's development, it's probably the right decision, but circumstances, Stahlberg's still here. But, you know, here's this guy, Victor Stahlberg, who comes into a championship. This is, you know, last week, Buddy Oakes talked about the Predator way. I mean, there should be a Blackhawk way. There should be a championship way here. It's like Victor Stahlberg comes from the Toronto Maple Leafs, and you have all these guys that leave, and there's now these spots open, and Victor Stahlberg has the camp that he did. Like, how dare he? You know, expect more from a guy like Victor Stahlberg. Just skating hard and occasionally getting a scoring chance and throwing pucks on net that aren't all that dangerous, that's not enough for me. I want to see the guy going hard to the net. I want to see what separates Marian Hossa from a lot of other guys. The fact that he goes to the net and he stays there. Especially on that second goal, the game-tying goal last night. There's no flybys. There's no, well, I'm going to sort of creep up on the net and sort of stand out here. No, Marian Hossa is standing on top of Yaroslav Halak. And that's how he scored. Those weren't highlight goals. Not all of Hossa's goals are going to be like that. Taves is a, you know, when he's going, he's going to score a lot of goals like that this year. If a guy like Stahlberg can only, you know, his only chances and Skilly's only chances, although Skilly's a lot better than Stahlberg at this, is from shooting from 15, 20, 40 feet out, he's not going to score a lot of goals. It's just not how you get it done. The goalies are too good. You've got to show more. You've got to go to the net. You've got to be aggressive. You've got to want to score goals. Not, you know, throw a bunch of shots at net and then bury your head between your legs on the bench and say, oh, tonight's just not my night. But I'm really fast, and you know, we're really working hard out there, coach. Put us out there more. No. Go to the net and score some fucking goals. You know, you don't get anything just because there's a spot open. You got to earn your spot. And maybe that's what Joe Quenneville's doing with these two clowns, Skilly and Stahlberg. And I think fans should expect more. You're the fans of a championship team. You don't give out spots to clowns from other organizations. All right. talk more about that. Most likely going to be in Rockford on Saturday night, watching Rockford and the Chicago Wolves play. Should be interesting.
Yeah, it should be very.
I'm sure the city of Rockford is going to be just overjoyed once they hear I'm coming.
Yeah.
They're
already on high alert.
A couple more notes since I have them. Evan Brophy's not, I don't know that, I think the Evan Brophy, unless he somehow turns it on and I don't know, I think the Evan Brophy era is done here in Chicago. He's not getting a whole heck of a lot of ice time, according to reports. I haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of Rockford hockey yet. Sean Lalonde, I know that his numbers look good, but what I'm hearing doesn't jive with his numbers, with his plus-minus. I mean, I know he was a wreck in Peoria last Tuesday, and, you know, that was a 6-2 loss, and Peoria scored a bunch on the power play. But I'm very interested to see Lalonde, because what I'm hearing doesn't jive with his numbers. So we'll look at that. Bob Probert book. Got to get you a copy of this here in a few days, Superstar, so we can talk about this more, a little bit more. I'll have a column most likely in the Committee on India next week just talking about this book. We'll do a much larger piece on the book once people get a chance to read it. I don't want to spoil everything, and I won't spoil everything for everybody tonight. But I think it's important to talk about the book. Of course, it comes out at the end of the month. I think you can order it now on Amazon. And it'll probably, I think the official release date on the book is October 30th. Typically, your major chains like Borders and such, Barnes & Noble, have the book in a few days early. Major books, anyway. I don't know that this is a major book. It certainly doesn't have the buzz that the Theo Fleury book had. And I don't know why. You know, Bob Probert recently passed, but it just doesn't seem to have the same buzz as Theo Fleury's story did. But
it blocked it for the lack of making a bad joke. That's because sex sells.
That is a bad joke. You know, I have mostly skipped around the book. I haven't started reading cover to cover, but I've read a lot of it. I'm going to sit down probably starting on Thursday and read it cover to cover. God, you know, on one hand, I'm pleasantly surprised with the book, but I think that in part I can't really, you know, my criticism comes with an asterisk in that Bob Probert did die before they were done, you know, done with the book. So towards the end, it sort of, you know, it doesn't, to me, it doesn't seem complete. And, you know, there's stuff at the end of the book that's talked about. One thing that, unless I'm missing it, again, I've been jumping around, I mean, it goes in chronological order, so I don't think I'm missing it. It does not mention his Blackhawks Heritage Night at all, even though he talks about stuff that did take place after, like dancing or skating, you know, the CBC skating Battle of the Blades. They talk about that. You know, the thing that I'm coming away from this book with is that I'm not even all that interested in Bob Probert. I am fascinated with his wife, and I don't even really know how to define it, but you know, his wife, Dani Probert, you know, through everything, stuck with him. And, you know, everything that, you know, you just don't know. I mean, I'm finding it a hard time trying to figure out why. You know, this is a Bob Probert that continuously, the idea that, oh, he, you know, he did drugs, you know, he drank a lot, crashed his motorcycle, got into trouble and all that kind of stuff. Not that. But the fact that, and you'll read it in incidents in the book, that he clearly chose drugs and alcohol over his family countless times. And she always stayed with him. She knew, and this is something that, you know, I don't know if I want to read a couple of passages out of here. Let's see where I got it now. But she knew of his infidelity. And Bob Probert even says in the book, you know, in his post-playing days, it became almost like a game. In his words, that, you know, Probert would, you know, he liked the women, and he would go out and he would have fun. And then, you know, Windsor's a small town, you know, word would get around, and his wife would constantly, Danny would constantly confront him on it. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me. I'm more fascinated with Danny Probert and what, I mean, I want to read her book, and I want to know her version of this story, because, you know, I think, obviously, this book is what Bob Probert wants people to hear, and I think people that love Bob Probert and want to continue to love Bob Probert will like this book. There's a lot of things that I think, even if you're a Bob Probert apologist, that you'll read and you'll be like, wow, oh boy, you know. But, you know, interesting thing, when he talks about Steve Chazon, of course, Steve Chazon in 1999, playing with the Carolina Hurricanes, is eliminated in the playoffs by the Boston Bruins. You know, he goes out with some of his teammates, gets drunk, drives home, and you know, single car crash, and he dies. Steve Chazon and Bob Probert were friends, you know, and, you know, because they had played together in Detroit. Well, this is, of course, written, you know, before Bob Probert, you know, eventually dies. Bob Probert very angry with Jimmy Delvano, because Jimmy Delvano talks to, you know, is quoted after the Steve Chazon death, and he basically says that, you know, the organization always knew that they were going to have a problem with Steve Chazon one day, and they labeled Chazon as an alcoholic. You know, and that they, you know, again, they basically got rid of him because of it. And you could say, make the same, you know, case for why Bob Probert did not play his entire career with Detroit. It's because it just came to a point where they knew they couldn't control him, and, you know, if on the path that he was on, it was going to end very badly. Now, Probert got himself right enough that didn't, you know, it didn't happen that way. But that's why he was booted out of Detroit. Of course, Bob Probert has his own version of what happened here, and it's probably pretty close to the truth, if it's not the truth entirely. You know, you have to get everybody in a room together and talking about it to sort of figure out what the real truth is, so, and I don't know that we're ever going to get that. But in talking about Steve Chazon, I guess I'll read this. This is about Bob Probert's words talking about Jimmy Delvano and saying that, you know, they sort of suspected that something like this would happen. He said the Wings had tried to help him with his alcoholism, and it's too bad that in the end it had to cost him his life, or something like that. Again, Bob Probert's words. I mean, why bring that shit up? He's dead, okay? Basically, they're calling him an alcoholic and saying that is why he died, which is not true. He had a few beers with the guys, period. I hope that at my funeral, people who helped me don't go yapping about my problems. Shut up, you know. That's why I'm writing my own book, to tell it my way before something else or someone else screws it up. Well, I mean, whether or not Steve Chazon was an alcoholic is really irrelevant. I mean, alcohol and bad decisions, you know, after using alcohol or, you know, led to his death. I mean, there's no way around that. You know, and the story behind Steve Chazon, and Bob Probert tells it in the book, is that Steve Chazon actually, his teammates would call him a cab, and he went outside to go have a smoke, and he was standing there waiting, and he just said, no, you know, my car's right there, I'm just going to drive home. And he got, you know, a few blocks down the street. He wasn't that far from home, and he crashed his car, and he died. You know, but you can't, you know. Bob Probert, you know, in this book, Bob Probert is continuously, much like Theo Fleury, it's not denial. It's a lack of accountability and a belief that you're invincible. You know, and I don't want to. In some of the stories that I've read so far, it's almost like Bob Probert is like telling you the story and almost like, not to the extent that Theo Fleury seemed like they were a badge of honor, like he was proud that he had done all this stuff and he had lived through it. You know? But there's a little bit of that from Bob Probert. You know, he rubs me the wrong way in that, you know, he talks about the day that he was let go, and this is a big one, the day that he's let go, finally, from the Blackhawks in 2002. And I'm thumbing through the book here trying to find it. But the day that he's let go, November 13th, 2002, the day that he's told that he's done. Because if you remember back, in the 2002-03 season, Bob Probert just wasn't playing, and he was sort of in limbo, and then finally the team said, you know what, we'll continue to pay you your contract, but we're not going to play you. Brian Sutter was not going to play him. Bob Probert, in reality, had outlived his usefulness by at least three seasons. He didn't think that. We'll talk about that in a second. But on that day, he called home, and his wife, Danny, you know, learns the news that he's been let go and his hockey career is effectively over. His wife informs him, again, this is the story that Bob Probert tells in his book. His wife informs him that her grandmother died. So on the same day that Bob Probert's NHL career ends, the end of the line, he learns that his wife's grandmother has passed away, and that she wants him to rush home so they can go up to Toronto and be with her family for, you know, her passing grandmother. Instead, Bob Probert, who throughout this book, you know, or through the latter stages of the book, when he addresses going to Chicago and having to be clean, he basically says, you know what, I'm just going to stay clean. He says this in the book. His idea was that all he had to do was stay clean until the end of his career, and then he could go back to doing what he wanted to do. He was going to make the money, he would do what he had to do to make the money, and then once his career was over, he could go back to doing whatever the fuck he wanted. And that's what he says in the book. You know, makes sense, but again, he refused to believe that he had a problem. And continuously over the course of his life, he just refused to address it. And how it affected his family over and over and over and over and over again. And he acknowledged it. He always says that he loves his family. He talks throughout the book about how he loved his family and they're everything to him. And there's a story about him and Doug Gilmore speaking at a seminar or something. And Bob Probert didn't know what the heck he was going to say. He was very nervous. And Doug Gilmore turns to him and just says, "Talk about your family. You always talk about them anyway." So he loved his family. But in the end, He never acted it out. He talked about it. He said it, but the actions weren't there. So on November 13th, you know, Bob Probert gets let go. He's, instead of going up and being with his wife to grieve with her and support her, he goes out and gets loaded. Never makes it to Toronto for his wife's grandmother's funeral. And then there's another story in here, which Bob Probert includes his daughter. You know, his daughter was a cross-country runner, and she had a big cross-country meet in which she came. I'll never find it in the next 2 seconds. So she comes in like 15th or 18th out of 100 other girls. She's 12 years old. And she writes this letter afterwards about how she invited both her mommy and her daddy to the meet, but her daddy didn't show, and how she hated her daddy, and she her daddy always lets her down, and this time she really hates him, and she uses that verbiage. Of course, she's 12 years old, and she says that she's not going to speak to her daddy for another 2 weeks. But what was Bob Probert doing? He was out getting loaded. Again, time and time and time again, we learn this. And again, this is what fascinates me. What brought this woman to continually support him? It's more fascinating than anything that Bob Probert talks about in the book is everything else that he doesn't talk about. Now, we were always led to believe, and we always sort of kind of figured that this wasn't true, but we were always led to believe that in the course of Bob Probert's career, he was always clean. But of course, I mean, it was part of his contract. I mean, if he didn't stay clean, he didn't get paid, right? If he didn't stay clean, he was going to be suspended again. He was going back into the substance abuse program, right? Well, not true. First of all, interesting tidbit that, I don't know that many people would know. The motorcycle wreck that effectively ended any chance that he had of being a Red Wing, continuing to being a Red Wing in 1994, the motorcycle wreck, which, of course, Bob Probert ends up in a hospital. They take a bunch of blood and urine tests. He winds up not only with alcohol in his system, which is what caused the wreck, but they find cocaine in his system. What you don't know, or what he talks about in here, is that he comes up to Chicago once free agency starts. He talks to the Blackhawks. He agrees, in principle, to a deal. Of course, the Red Wings have right of first refusal. So that's where it ends. He goes back home, celebrates. He goes to a strip club. He drinks. He does some coke. And then he gets pulled over on the way home from that night. He doesn't have a license on him. He's loaded. He's drunk. But the cop recognizes that he's Bob Probert and lets him go. That's days before he crashes his bike. I mean, this is clearly a guy that, another question to ask about Danny Probert. And Probert, throughout the book, it seems like Danny was upset with him, at least the way he tells the story. She was upset that he was the way he was, but she wasn't overly aggressive in getting him to change, which is also fascinating. And again, that's his version of the story. But I don't know. So, a couple of things. So, we all know the story now. Bob Murray approaches Bob Probert in 1999 because Bob Probert is no longer useful to the hockey club, not on any sort of grand level. In 98-99, Bob Probert gets into 78 games. He's got 7 goals. He's still a fighter. The same fire that was there, like in his days with the Red Wings and even his first 2 years with the Blackhawks, the fire is gone. And part of that is in 97-98, he misses pretty much the entire season with a shoulder issue. So the fire is gone, and Bob Murray wants to renegotiate his deal. Bob Probert basically tells him to go fuck himself. Which was his right. I would never say that a NHL player shouldn't, demand that he gets what he negotiated. I mean, that's his right. So that's fine. But in 1999, Bob Probert is quoted in the book as saying that he was appalled because Bob Murray told Bob Probert that he was nothing more than a fourth liner. Okay, that really angered Bob Probert. Still to the day, when he writes the book, he was appalled by it. He says, how dare he say, he's an idiot. In the book, this is Probert writing, page 204. Murray was gone by Christmas, and so was Lorne Mollican. Pulley was back behind the bench by December 2nd. Our record up to then, was 5-15-4, which is true. Here's where it gets juicy or humorous. I was moved to the first line with Doug Gilmore and Tony Amani. By January, we're just skipping ahead a bit. By January, we were back on a good streak, 8-4-2. So Bob Probert is saying, he's implying there, that Bob Murray was wrong. Bob Probert wasn't a fourth liner. He was actually a first liner. And when Bob Pulford went ahead and put Proby back on the first line with Doug Gilmore and Tony Amani, suddenly the Blackhawks' fortunes had changed, and now they went on an 8-4-2 streak. Bob Probert continues, I quote, "What goes around comes around," as they say. In the 1999-2000 season, Bob Probert played in 69 games. He scored 4 goals, including that stint on the top line with Doug Gilmore and Tony Amani. He was a fourth liner. The very next page, page 205, as we skip ahead to the next season, Bob Probert says, "My role with the team shifted as the years went by." Of course, we're only talking about 1 year. "By 2000-2001, I was playing up the fourth line, but that was cool. I was still having fun." Okay? It was apparent during that season, and even before, that Bob Probert had mentally checked out. We talked about this before. The last 3 or 4 seasons that Bob Probert played, he wasn't mentally into it. And he admits as such, but he's not admitting till such to 2000-2001. The following season, of course, the 2001-2002 season, is the year that Brian Sutter enters the equation. Now, I mean, we don't have time. We're running along. We don't have time to go into this. But, of course, Bob Probert doesn't like Bob Murray. He loves Bob Pulford. They're kindred spirits, apparently, and he does write that in the book. He talks about it. He also hated Dirk Graham, and in his mind, and the argument can certainly be made, Dirk Graham was a lousy head coach, and he talks about it and cites reasons. A couple of good stories of Dirk Graham as a head coach in the book. But in the 2000-2001 season, Brian Sutter's not playing Probert a lot, and in fact, Probert, his spot on the team is essentially taken over by Jim Campbell. People remember Jimmy Campbell. So by the end of the season, Bob Probert doesn't care anymore. Of course, the 2001-02 season, the Blackhawks were a pretty damn good team. Went to the playoffs. That was the last time before 2009 that the Blackhawks were in the postseason. Well, while all that was going on in March and April, Bob Probert fell off the wagon. He didn't care anymore. He was drinking, and he was going out and partying, and he was going crazy. You ask, this is all that he admits to in the book. According to Bob Probert, and this was also interesting, in his previous 6 years with the Blackhawks, all he did was drink O'Doul's. Now, why someone who's an alcoholic, who could fall off the wagon at any time, is even drinking O'Doul's to begin with, I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me. Does it make sense to you?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Seems like it would make it worse.
Yeah, but that's what he said. He said in 6 years, his first six years with the Hawks, he didn't drink anything stronger than an O'Doul's. So, but basically, Bob Probert was, scamming on the piss test. Now, when you're on the road, those things get sprung up on you, usually, typically at the arena, or, you get back from, the bus takes you back from practice, you get to the hotel, and I don't have any confidence whatsoever in the NHL's current drug testing policy. I think it's a joke. But, what Probert was under was random testing. So if they were on the road and the NHL ordered a test, you'd either get to the arena or so on the road, he had to be more careful. But at home, he had it down to a science, and he tells you how he did it. A random test would be the tester would call you 2 or 3 hours ahead of time to make sure that when he got there, you were home, which I guess in Chicago kind of makes sense. It could take the guy a while to get there. He wants to make sure you're there when you get there. I guess that kind of makes sense.
So Bob Probert would always have clean piss on him, and he would keep it in his apartment. He would, you know, we'd have it there. And then when the knock on the door came from the piss tester, he'd put the piss in the microwave for 12 seconds. Because, you know, when piss comes out of your body, it's typically 96.5 or so degrees. So he'd put it in the microwave, run it for 12 seconds. He'd put it into a vial. He'd stick it into his underwear. And then the guy came in, they'd go into the bathroom. And, of course, he'd be, most guys don't want you, at, you know. You could stand there, over, you know, behind you, and, you know, but this is a common practice, specifically in wrestling, which you have a vial there. And then you have the cup, and while you're pissing, you squeeze the vial into the cup, and that's what Bob Probert was doing. So surprise, surprise, Bob Probert wasn't clean as a Blackhawk.
Shocking, really.
And again, it's all that he admits to, but. Yeah, we'll talk more about the book once you get a copy of A Superstar and I'm able to read it cover to cover and then write about it. But I do recommend it. I think it's fascinating for all the reasons that I just said, and I haven't even gotten into a lot of the Red Wings stuff yet. But, I do recommend it, and hopefully, like the Fleury book, we'll have some copies to give away here in the coming weeks for people to check out. But I guess that's about it tonight, Superstar.
All right.
What do we got coming up? Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, October 20th at the United Center, Vancouver Canucks are in town. Blackhawks with the rematch. It's actually St. Louis's next game. For St. Louis, this is a home-and-home. Friday night, down at Scott Trade Center, Blackhawks and Blues go at it again. And then Saturday night, Columbus is in town. And then I believe the Blackhawks next, I don't have a schedule in front of me, but I believe the Blackhawks next game after that is L.A. Next Wednesday night, Dustin Brown in town.
Ooh.
I should be very excited. And there could be a chance that I might be walking around the United Center tomorrow night in my Kevin Bieksa jersey.
Nice.
That all depends on what time I can get out of the office tomorrow afternoon. Although it is a late start, 8 o'clock start, in case people don't know about that. Late start tomorrow night at the UC, which just means people are going to get more drunk.
Yeah.
All right, Superstar. Thanks a lot for joining us. Next Tuesday night, October 26th, we'll be back, 8 o'clock here. We got to talk eventually here, in one of the next couple of weeks, we got to start talking about the media and what's going on with the media, sports, not just in this town, but all together. I don't know if we'll do that next week or maybe somewhere down the road, but we definitely got to start talking about that. Some changes are going to be coming up with thethirdmanin.com as well. We'll talk about that and probably some drastic changes about how I operate, but we'll talk about those eventually. But again, Superstar, thank you very much for joining me.
And you know,
everyone as well for listening. All right. Again, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Tuesday night, October 26th at 8 p.m. here at blogtalkradio.com/thethirdmanin, also on iTunes and thethirdmanin.com. Good night, everybody.